Macro Voices is pleased to bring you this encore presentation of an interview which originally aired in full color video on Real Vision Television at an earlier date. Real Vision is a paid subscription video on demand channel for finance. In partnership with Real Vision Television, we are pleased to offer Macro Voices subscribers a free trial subscription to Real Vision. To sign up, go to realvisiontv.com/discount/macrovoices. Macro Voices does not receive any commission or other compensation if you purchase a Real Vision subscription. We are proud to promote Real Vision because we believe they are the only other financial media outlet that shares our values and standards in financial journalism.
This is Aaron Chen of Macro Voices. For this week's Real Vision Television Encore presentation, we bring to you an interview which was originally published on January 5th, 2016, between Grant Williams of Real Vision TV and Willem Middelkoop, founder of the Commodity Discovery Fund and author of the worldwide bestseller The Big Reset. Willem's expansive knowledge on monetary history, precious metals, and commodities makes this a must-listen interview for the global economic mess in which we currently find ourselves. Although recorded back in January, he was already making a compelling case for investing in gold and silver miners, which have since appreciated over 100% if you go by the GDX index. In particular, I think you'll find his discussion about China's monetary ambitions and amassing of gold, all within the context of a US-dominated monetary system, to be particularly insightful and topical given China's inclusion in the SDR effective October 1st. All this is wrapped into Willem's hypothesis that our current global monetary system is wholly unsustainable and a big reset is on the way. So thanks for listening, and don't forget to take advantage of an exclusive 10% discount on RVTV subscriptions by signing up at realvisiontv.com/discount/macrovoices.
Okay, I'm here with Willem Middelkoop, founder of the Commodities Discovery Fund and the author of the book The Big Reset, which you very kindly sent me a copy of a couple of years ago. And I want to talk to you about The Big Reset today, because I know you're about to publish an update with, I think you told me, 30,000 extra words.
Yeah, 70 new pages, a revised edition. So much happening.
That's how much things change. So why don't we get it? Let's talk about what The Big Reset is and what it's all about.
The Big Reset is a thesis that we need a reset, a monetary reset. Actually, it's moving international monetary system towards a new phase. We've seen resets in the past. They weren't called resets, but 1944, Bretton Woods, was a reset of the international monetary system. There were two ideas on the table, the American idea to use the dollar as a new world standard, as a new gold standard. And there was a idea by Keynes, British idea, to start using the bankor, new currency, IMF currency, and the British lost. So the dollar became the world reserve currency.
Yeah. It's funny, you talk about that. That's a reset that happened in our lifetime. But people, when you talk about stuff like this, a reset of the global monetary system, it's such a big concept for people to get their heads around.
Oh yeah.
They mostly assume you're crazy.
Yeah,
right?
It's very hard for people to have the mental flexibility.
Correct.
To start to begin to understand that you can change a monetary system, because people view a monetary system as something like climate or something given by nature or God. Yeah. Financial system is always created, and we have seen. I'm a student of monetary history. And I think the best books on the economy are written by historians, not by economics. So if you study monetary history and financial history, well, you find out that we've had hundreds of monetary resets after each period of hyperinflation, Weimar 1923, a new money system was created nationally. But this is the first time, I think, in world history that we could have a real worldwide monetary reset. Because in the past, the Russians in 1944, they were also present at the Bretton Woods conference, But after decisions were made, they stepped out of the system. So the communists, they had their own economic system. Yeah. But after fall of communism, they accepted the dollar system as it is. So now we live in a world in which the whole world is connected in this monetary system. So I think this will be the first time we go towards a worldwide monetary reset.
To me, the thing about this time that feels like, you talk about being the first time it's a worldwide one, the sheer quantum of the debt that's built up this time makes me feel like this one will be the biggest reset we've had, because it's going to expose the most frailties, it's going to do the most damage to the existing system. And I suspect that's why they're fighting so hard to try and push the day that reset happens as far down the road as they can.
Yeah, you can see a monetary reset as a plan B. And you can't talk about plan B when you're still in plan A, because we have to keep trusting plan A. So if they start to discuss plan B, everybody would lose trust and would have Marx collapse. So that's why talks about a monetary reset are only held after closed doors, behind closed doors. We know there have been a few conferences. Jean-Claude Trichet, he traveled to Beijing in November 2014 to discuss a new financial system with the Chinese. There have been some reports about it, but very few. But there are two major problems we need to solve. One is a restructuring of debts in advanced economies, Japan, EU, US. And the other big problem is we need to find a new anchor for the monetary system. And the anchor has been, since 1944, since the reset of Bretton Woods, has been the dollar. And the Chinese have been very clear, especially since the fall of Lehman, that they do not longer accept the dollar as the anchor for the monetary system for a longer term. So for the next few years, it's okay. But the Chinese are putting tons of pressure on the IMF, on the US, to change the system. And that's why the renminbi had to be added to the SDR, because it's the Chinese wish to upgrade the SDR, the special drawing rights of the IMF, towards the new anchor for the financial system. But this will take years.
Well, but it's interesting, because we're talking in the week that's finally happened. I mean, the SDR now includes the renminbi. Or it will do from October.
That's why it's so significant.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about that, because the Chinese are clearly moving towards their own little kind of sphere of monetary payments. They've started all their new payment systems. Mm-hmm. They're looking at trading oil and gold for yuan, renminbi in the free trade zone.
There's the currency a lot swaps of, with all the countries.
Correct. This stuff's all been going on, and it's been going on for a number of years now. And like many things, that are a little bit, that require two steps to understand, people kind of just ignore them.
They see them as separate incidents.
Yes.
They don't see the broader picture.
Right.
And I think I understand why, because everybody in power is trying to send out the message that nothing serious is wrong with the current system, even the Chinese. If you study all academic papers, you will find the real answers and you will understand what their objectives are and where they want to travel to. But they won't give a press conference stating in 5 years' time the dollar will be finished as the anchor for the financial system. Because they, and this is very important to understand, because Russia and Putin, he's on a collision course with the West. But the Chinese, they want cooperation, no confrontation. You know the Chinese. Yeah. They want to do business with everybody. So the Chinese, in a way, are very open about their wishes and their plans. And that's why I could write the book, study all the academic papers, talk to people. The Chinese were very happy with the book, because it has been published by the Renmin University in Beijing, which is directly connected to the Communist Party. So this shows that Chinese are happy that this story is out, but they will not promote it themselves actively.
Let's talk about the story. Let's talk about what your suggestion is for what this big reset looks like, because it's really fascinating.
Yeah. when people ask me, well, Willem, what scenario will unfold? I have to admit, I don't know.
No, none of us do. That's.
And actually, I state in the book that the worldwide system is not a binary system. You know, it's not zero or one. I think we can have 256 shades of gray.
That's a whole different book. Let's not get into that.
But you can change the system in almost any way we want. And the financial system is always an agreement between the major trading blocks in the world. Not everybody has to agree. When the major trading blocks agree on the basis functions of the system and agreements, you know, you have a new system. And a few things are certain. We need to find a new anchor for the financial system. We can't get rid of the US, we can't get rid of the dollar, so that's why the SDR is such a perfect solution for China and the US. Because within the SDR, the dollar still has the main...
Yeah, it's 60-odd% yeah.
And during the changes which we've seen in this week, renminbi being added to the SDR, the weight of the euro came down, the weight of the pound came down, not the weight of the dollar.
Yeah.
So I know some Chinese economists who don't like the SDR solution because they're more aggressive. They would like to see bigger changes. But I think the Chinese leadership understands a monetary reset can only be accomplished with the help of the US and with the help of the IMF. And that's why the SDR is the only solution, because that's the only currency we can upgrade as an anchor for the financial system, in which still the dollar has this large component. So actually, I write in the book that the US wants to stay in the driver's seat, and they will be in the driver's seat when this will be an IMF-controlled reset.
Well, I mean, there's another big matzo ball hanging out there, which is, you know, the other currency, obviously, is gold. Right, that's the other solution. It's not a total solution, or it likely won't be the total solution, but it feels to me, common sense tells you that after an era of pure fiat, when it goes wrong, you have to go back some way to sound money.
That's why the Chinese have been pushing to add gold as a sixth currency to the SDR. So first step was bringing renminbi into the SDR, making a renminbi real international reserve currency, has been accomplished now. There's a Chinese wish to add gold as a sixth currency. I think there's strong opposition from the US, there's strong opposition from IMF, but it might be needed at a certain point. And there are some very interesting comments made about this in the past. Robert Zoellick, he was the president of the World Bank, in the 2000s, and he wrote a open letter to the Financial Times 2003 proposing using gold and the renminbi in a new monetary system. And we have seen some other comments. I'm in the advisory board of the ONVIF. ONVIF is a London-based think tank on monetary affairs. And our chairman, Lord Desai, he said in the conference, during a conference in Dubai last year, it might be a very good idea to add gold to the SDR. And actually he said, I expect this to happen in the future. So it's not a wild idea that gold will come back to the monetary system.
But what you've done, you had the SDR, you've reduced the weighting of the euro primarily, plus the yen, plus the pound, and a tiny reduction in the dollar. And you've added another currency, which is pegged to the dollar.
Yeah.
And then you want to talk about adding gold, which is quoted in dollars.
Yeah.
So this, you know, this dollar-centric bias gets stronger to a point. And it brings us on to the question of what the Chinese do with their currency. There's been a lot of speculation. Does it appreciate? Does it depreciate? It feels to me like they will need to depreciate it. The flows suggest it may appreciate. What do you see happening to the yuan now it's in the SDR?
That's a very difficult question. I like to concentrate on the bigger picture. So for me, it's much more important questions. Why are the Chinese accumulating that much gold? Because it's a known fact that the Chinese are accumulating massive amounts of gold.
Well, it's a known supposition, right? To people that watch the gold markets have a certain idea of what's going on in China, and I subscribe to that view completely. Yeah. The facts, as we know them, are what the Chinese have told us, right? Which is that no, we haven't been buying it. We've just bought a little amount of gold, and we're adding to it slowly.
It's part of the truth, because in June this year, the Chinese made public that the official gold reserves by the People's Bank of China have increased by 600 tons. We all know this was the first revision since 2009, so over 6 years they have kept silent and have been adding gold secretly. Since June, they changed their reporting system, and now they report their new gold holdings every month. So we know they're accumulating gold. We also know from statements made during speeches that they have this strategy to accumulate the largest gold reserves in the shortest possible time. This is a quote, a statement by a Chinese official. We also know, because this was published in June this year on the website of the People's Bank of China, that they have this program, which translated from Chinese characters in English, is storing gold with the people. It's mentioned on the website of the People's Bank of China. So what does this mean? That China, it's China's policy not only to accumulate gold as reserves for the People's Bank of China, but also make sure that there's as much gold in within the country accumulated by the people, by commercial banks, by companies. And you know the graph. If you look at the total physical amount of gold accumulated since 2005, when the gold market was opened in China, it's 13,000 tons now. And that's an incredible amount, especially given the official gold reserve of only 1,600 tons.
But see, and this whole thing is fascinating to me because, you know, you and I, amongst other things, we spend a lot of time looking at the gold market and understanding the flows and understanding the demand and supply situation.
Because it's a currency.
Right.
Yeah.
But when you look at it closely, all this is actually very clear to see. I mean, you don't have absolute proof because you can't actually audit every bar of gold that goes anywhere. But it's very clear to see what's happening here, this enormous shift of physical gold from west to east. And yet, whenever anything's written about gold, it's generally written by people that don't pay close attention to these things.
So then, I've learned a lot, and I used his information a lot, from James Rickards. Because you know James Rickards. James Rickards is a Wall Street insider. He was present during the LT CM disaster. And James Rickards has been a participant of economic war games within the Pentagon. Well, he wrote about it, so it's out in the open. And the best explanation for China accumulating all this gold it comes from his last book, The Death of Money. And he has made very clear that there is some kind of agreement between China and the US in which the US accepts that China will build gold reserve which are the same compared to the size of their economy, like the US. The US has 8,000 tons of gold. Europe has over 11,000 tons of gold. So China is allowed to accumulate, let's say, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 tons of gold. And when China has reached this position, the US, Europe, and China are on the same level, on a monetary gold level, to work together towards a bigger step in this monetary reset. And it's my idea that gold might be revaluated at some point by central bankers to a much higher level. And by revaluating gold towards $4,000 or $8,000 an ounce, you solve quite a lot of problems.
Yeah, absolutely. But you simultaneously create a whole bunch of problems as well, which is the problem. I mean, that's...
But we know plan A, the current financial system, will end. We can't go on this way. So we need some big changes along the way. And a revaluation of gold has helped central bankers in the past.
Yep.
Roosevelt did it in the 1930s.
But that was a 20%. That was a 20% devaluation of the dollar that Roosevelt came up with, right? We're talking now with the dollar valued at $42 and on the Fed's balance sheet. We're talking of taking it to $4,000.
Well,
that's a whole different.
Yeah, but the U.S. gold reserves are still valued. Look at the balance sheet of the Treasury
sure.
and the Federal Reserve. There's only $11 billion worth of right. gold reserves because it's valued at historical cost price of $42
yeah.
an ounce. If you would revalue gold to $4,200 an ounce, this $11 billion becomes $1.1 trillion. If you would revalue gold towards $8,400 an ounce, the $11 billion on the balance sheet becomes $2.2 trillion. So it would would really help to restore the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve and the Treasury. In another transaction, which you could do in the same weekend, you could get rid of the $2 trillion position of U.S. Treasuries on the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve, because U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve can both agree to just get rid of this position. So by these two quite simple steps, you can recapitalize the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve. And since ECB and the People's Bank of China both have this large gold position, a revaluation of gold would also help them, although their gold reserves are marked, their price marked to market.
Yeah, well, it's okay, but let's talk about, because for anyone watching that doesn't follow the gold market, doesn't understand its place in the monetary system, yeah. talk a little bit about, because that sounds like such a simple solution,
oh, yeah.
right? And you go, well, let's do that. But talk a little bit about the flip side of that coin, because it does create a world of other problems.
Well, I think it will solve a lot of problems.
Sure.
Because, of course, central bankers are quite afraid that too many people will start fleeing towards gold. So that's why pension funds are not allowed to buy physical gold. I'm a fund manager myself. Within the permits we have, we're not allowed to invest in physical gold, only in financial products connected to gold. So,
which is laughable. I mean,
yeah,
if you think about it, it's laughable.
It's laughable. So, by revaluating gold to a level of $4,000 or $8,000, you make gold that expensive that the general public can't buy gold anymore. So then gold becomes too expensive for the general public. So you can't flee towards gold anymore. So gold will be used only as an anchor for this new financial system and will be only owned by central banks. And then the big question is, what will happen with the gold mines? Do they have to sell to the central banks? Are they allowed to still sell it on an open market? But revaluating gold will solve the problem that too many people will start fleeing towards gold.
But you create an inflationary problem.
But they want, central bankers want to
not
cause
that kind of inflation. But not that kind of inflation. I mean, that's...
Because well,
that's this nirvana of this 2%, this magic yeah. unicorn figure of 2% inflation, which we all know is impossible to get to yeah. and sustain. Yeah. What they're trying to do is create it, and the markets are not cooperating because we were in this massive deleveraging cycle, and the natural path from here is deflationary. It's a collapsing of yeah. some of the excess debts. But that's not going to stop them. They're going to keep going, trying to
yeah.
get this thing. And they will win. Eventually, you know, we've never had an extended period of deflation. Forget Japan. It always ends in inflation because they will keep going until they get it. And when they get it, they normally get it good and hard, and they won't be able to stop
yeah.
this thing, right? If you then combine that with revaluing gold to $4,000 an ounce, you compound the problem.
The new target for central banks is 4% now. Huh? They've been talking about 4%.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's still being discussed. We had a new Labour leader here in England. He was calling for QE for the people. We have seen a former Minister of Finance, Eichel, in Germany, calling for QE for smaller companies. We have seen ideas of restarting QE to build more infrastructure in the world. China is calling for this, you know. we should be well aware that we'll have more smaller steps before we'll get the real big monetary reset in which gold might be revalued. So I think we can expect in 2016, 2017, more QE to reach an inflation target of 4%, 2 to 4%. When this eventually won't be enough and the inflation targets won't be reached and more unorthodox steps have to be taken within the monetary system, we'll enter into the phase where a gold revaluation might occur. But I think the whole reset process will happen over a time span of 5, 10, 15, maybe even 20 years. So don't expect everything at once. We know what's in the toolbox of central bankers. The normal toolbox is almost empty, so they'll start to use more unorthodox strategies. But these unorthodox steps will be taken within Plan B and within Plan A. And at a certain point, Plan A is finished and we need a bigger reset towards the Plan B. And that's where the gold revaluation might get a place.
But I mean, when you look at QE and you talk about people's QE and QQE in Japan and you know, negative rates and all these things that they're, this is purely a function of the fact, it's the classic mistake. Nothing bad has happened, therefore nothing bad will happen, so we can continue doing this. You know, at some point, anybody who's either sane or not in charge understands this. I mean, this is, you're a monetary historian. You know, I read a lot of monetary history. This has never worked, and it will never work because it can never work.
But it can go on for a long time.
Correct.
Rome, you know, Rome, it's my opinion that the collapse of the Roman Empire was very much also the result of a debasement of its currency.
Yes.
Look at the silver contains in the coins, in the Roman coins, which the Roman soldiers received. You know, once there was no silver available, once they couldn't afford the silver to pay for the imperial overstretch. It was the first sign of imperial overstretch, or maybe not the first, but one of the early signs. So, but the collapse of the Roman Empire didn't happen within a few years. You know, this happened over a period of 100, 150 years. So it all starts with the debasement of currencies. Well, the dollar has been debased in 1971, you know? It lost its gold backing. And it can take 50 to 100 years before the US might lose all of its power and its economic empire. So we're in a process which takes a very long time. The US was the largest economy in 1870 already, but the US dollar became the main world's reserve currency in 1944. It was 70 years later. So when China will be the largest economy in 2020 or 2025, it might take until 2050 or 60 before the Chinese currency might become the main world reserve currency. And what's very interesting, for my visits to China, I learned that the Chinese, you know, they're very long-term thinkers, and they have this one special date they're working towards, and that's 2049. You know why? That's 100-year anniversary of the revolution. So the Chinese always tell me, these are all small steps towards our broader plan, being in control, being in charge of the world, or having our own system around 2050. So the Chinese are very long-term thinkers and planners in this respect. So the Chinese don't mind that the US will stay in control over the SDR and the IMF and the world monetary system until 2030 or 40.
What do you think? Why is it that Western democracies seem largely incapable of this long-term strategic thing? Is this purely a product of the welfare society, of having to give stuff away to people and continually promise people stuff, which isn't such a thing?
In the West, we see democracy as the one and only solution and acceptable form of organization. You know, there are many parts in this world, especially in the East, where the Chinese always say, you in the West, your politicians, they tell you they will do what you want, what you need. We do what the Chinese need. We just do it. And I think we've reached a point that maybe in history, if we look back in 100 years' time, when we'll not be around, but maybe we have to conclude that democracy isn't the only solution to govern the state, our country.
Yeah, it feels that way at the moment. Yeah.
And if you look at the amount of deception within the political system, the amount of corruption and bribery, look at the approval rates of the US Senate and Congress, you know, people understand all these people are bribed in one way or the other.
But what's also interesting is the awareness of that seems to be peaking now. People seem to be A, more aware about it, B, more motivated by it, and C, more likely to actually do something about it. You know, we're seeing this in the US with guys like Trump and Carson, streets ahead of old school politicians.
Europe the same. New politicians who are very successful and popular are anti-politicians, because people are fed up with the traditional politicians. And I have a nice example. I wrote my first book in 2007. And 2009, I went to a car wash. I was helped by a young guy, 17, it was a Saturday job. He said, oh, you wrote this book. He read it, he was a bright student. He said, well, it's worse than you tell me in the book. You know, the Fed is not owned by the government, it's privately owned. So this was a 17-year-old guy. And for me, he is like the new generation. Who understands? The new generation, people younger than 30, they understand they're fooled by politicians. They understand that the monetary system is deception. It's a Ponzi scheme. They all understand it. But we, who are over 40, especially people over 50, they don't have the mental flexibility to accept this.
But this younger generation, they're going to come up against this overarching sense they have that everything has to be fair and everybody has to have everything they need.
Yeah, and we share everything.
Yeah, and so, I mean, those two things cannot coexist, ultimately.
No, it collides. And, well, this is how revolutions are being made. And I wouldn't be surprised. I'm always very interested and quite obsessed by these moments in time when suddenly the whole world starts changing, like we've seen in 1914, 1917. Revolution started everywhere. You know, it was sign of the times. It was the end of the feudal system. So people revolted against the old money. Whilst we're still in Europe, in Holland, we have a monarchy. It's like North Korea, you know? We'll have to clap for the son of the king.
Right.
And it's a weird system. So sometimes I tend to think we reach the end of an era which we've lived in for the last 300-400 years. It's an era in which we invented the sovereign bonds. With sovereign bonds, we could have budget deficits forever. The British Royal Navy was financed by the sale of British bonds. So I'm working on a new book, and it will tell the story how empires have been made and collapsed within the last 1-2,000 years. And I can envision a longer term scenario in which the British Empire, which was followed by the American Empire, they're closely connected, and the same families are holding major strings of power in this Western financial system in which Wall Street is so dominant. And when I see the reactions from readers who are all pointing to the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, people start to understand there is a power somewhere. They don't understand who's holding the strings, and nobody's really holding the strings. But in Holland, we had our famous Prince Bernhard. He was like the key figure of the Bilderberg Conference. You know, the Bilderberg Conference was started in Holland, was based in Holland. And Prince Bernhard always said, there's a list of 5,000 families in this world. And if you know most of them, you know, you're connected. So there's the real power in the world. So when people ask me, does Rothschild own the world, or is Rothschild in control? I would say, no, the 5,000 families are in control. And we could reach a point in time where their power becomes at risk.
I find this fascinating, because I put a presentation together about this time last year, actually, about economics and war, and the inextricable links between the two. And there, no matter where you look in history, there are nexuses where they actually absolutely come into play. And you spoke about 1914, 1917, yeah. And the parallels between now and 1914 are too close to just dismiss as, And if you believe in cyclicality, which I do, and if you believe in, or you prefer it as the arc of a pendulum, whichever way you like to go, the current system, the current extreme of the pendulum, the current top in the cycle, is the most extreme we've had in terms of, if this extreme is endless prosperity for everybody and
can't be
limitless credit, as it swings back the other way, we're going to go somewhere dark. We're going to go somewhere people don't want to go.
Yesterday I saw a scary chart. We're here at the Minds and Money in London. And one of, I think it was a chief economist by Rio Tinto, and he showed a graph of commodity demands in world history. So last 200 years. And it's like this. You know, it's parabolic now. And this was the total demand for steel, copper, everything. Well, we all know we're commodity investors. We know that shortages in metals are around the corner. So for technical reasons, for geological reasons, you can't continue with this flight to the moon. So what will happen first? Will we have a collapse because we don't have enough copper left? Or will we have a collapse because every action will give a reaction, and this needs to topple over? But once this graph topples over, it will be the end of Western civilization like we know it. Right. And this is taboo subject. Nobody dares to go this way. And I think it won't happen. I'm 53. I'm always glad I'm 53, because I would think it won't happen in my lifetime. But it's a... this can't go on for another 100 or 200 years.
Right. Yeah. This becomes a supply and demand issue. But the kind of things we're talking about, these resets, they generally have to happen in the middle of a crisis. These aren't things that you can just say, okay, guys, hold everything.
No.
Here's what we're going to do. You need... I read a piece yesterday saying that since the attacks in Paris, they did a survey a week after the attacks in Paris, and 84% of French citizens would give up some of their freedom willingly to do this. So there's what happens in a crisis.
Never waste a good crisis.
Huh? Right, exactly right. So what we see, the Turkey and Russian tensions. We see China in the South China Seas with Japan and other and Vietnam. And these tensions are everywhere. And it feels as though, if anybody wants a good crisis, it's not going to be that difficult to create one.
When I was in China last time for a presentation of my book, I gave a presentation within the International Monetary Institute, which is a monetary think tank connected to the Communist Party. And we had a discussion on this topic. And actually, I was surprised. The Chinese asked me, what are you afraid of? What will the US do? And then I said, well, US has taken the initiative each and every time in the last 100 years. Start of the Federal Reserve, 1913. Roosevelt, the New Deal, 1933. Bretton Woods, 1944. 1971, closing of the gold window. So I think the US might surprise everybody with a unilateral reset. They could even introduce a new gold backed dollar. Ricketts has been given a scenario for that. So it, because Ricketts is James Ricketts is talking about this, we know this has been discussed during the economic war games, because that's where his scenarios. But
he also said in his book, interestingly enough, that the first time they ran these games, his team basically played the gold card, and they stopped the game and said, "Well, no, you can't do
that's
that.
That's not fair,
right? Yeah,
you can't accumulate gold."
Right. So,
but Russia is playing exactly the game plan of the red side during the Pentagon War Games. So, to come back to your question, what I do see is that the major powers in this world are positioning themselves for the new phase of the international monetary system and the new risks which are attached to these broader changes which might happen in the future. So it's not a coincidence that both Russia and China are accumulating gold, same amounts, 250 tons a year for central bank. It's no coincidence that China is backing Russia in many respects since the start of the crisis in Ukraine. The revised edition of my book, I talk a lot about the new financial economic warfare by the US. There's a book out now by a former Treasury official who was head of the group in 2001, who invented the financial economic war. You know, kicking Iran out of the Swiss system, accusing banks of money laundering. It's all part of financial economic warfare, bringing hyperinflation to a country, you know, Venezuela. It's very interesting. It hasn't been published a lot about this. And China is very afraid when the financial economic warfare, US warfare, against Russia, bringing down the price of oil, collapse of the ruble, when they will succeed, China could be at risk and be the next victim. So that's why China is backing Russia now. China understands there's a financial economic war fought by the US against Russia. And now Russia and China are joining forces, and also within the BRICS. We could also end up having a clash between the West and the East. But I'm quite sure China would like to choose the path of cooperation, not confrontation. But I'm quite sure that China is preparing for confrontation if needed. And in the South China Sea, they have actually said, you want to test us? Well, come and we'll have a war.
So in the middle of all that, and it's all just so fascinating, but you touched on commodities, and you're a commodity investor. That's what you do. You run a commodities fund. So let's just switch tacks for a little bit. We'll come back to gold later on, I think, because there's still plenty more to discuss. But talk a little bit about the commodity markets, because what we're seeing here is real, kind of feels like end of days stuff.
Yeah, the reason I do so much research for my books is because I'm an investor. So as an investor, you need to be ahead of the game. And once you know the game plan, and once you know the changes coming, you can adjust your portfolio and your position. And we've done a lot of studies on supply and demand for metals and commodities. And when we don't have a worldwide depression, we'll have shortages in important metals before 2025. Actually, if you study current supply and demand figures, there's a production deficit now in platinum, palladium, silver, gold. Copper is just, there's no real deficit, but deficits are coming before 2020. In zinc, we'll see serious mining production shortages, deficits, before 2020, because 10 to 15 major zinc mines will close down in the next few years. Silver is a byproduct of copper, of zinc and lead. So when zinc mines close down, you'll lose a lot of silver production. And silver is very interesting for investors because silver is poor man's gold. So it's a monetary metal, same like gold. So platinum and palladium are not monetary metals, so are less interesting from that point of view. But silver, we don't have a large amount of above the ground silver stocks anymore. Gold is always available. If they need to bring the gold price down, they always can find a few gold bars in the central bank safe. But silver is not owned by central banks anymore. So I expect silver shortages to happen before 2020. I've seen a study done by Silver Wheaton in the 1970s. We had above the ground silver stocks of 3 billion ounces because of all the old silver coins. The 3 billion ounces of silver stocks above the ground, they're all gone now because we needed them because the mine production is lower than demand now for over 30 years. And because the gold and silver price came down by 40% gold, 70% in silver in dollar terms, there's hardly any scrap available. You know, scrap availability is down by 40-50%. So the declines in gold price 40%, the silver 70%, while demand is up and production is peaking now. You know, for us as an investor, we know if you have a 3 to 5 year time frame, you know, you only can make money from this level. Of course, we lost a lot of money in the last few years, but I've been an investor in precious metals since 2002, 2003. I sold my real estate. I took profit on my Amsterdam real estate between 2001 and 2004. I started to invest in precious metals. So I made money on the 10 years up. Lost quite a bit of money now, but we're long-term investors. I'm 53 now. It's, for me, it's important. Where's the gold price? Where's the silver price when I'm 60, 65, 70? And that's what I always tell my investors. And we have 600 high net worth Dutch investors, which are very loyal. We had net inflows every year in the last 3 or 4 years. You can't lose on this one.
This is interesting because we get back to this idea of people that watch these markets closely and people that don't.
Yeah.
And if you don't watch these markets closely and you don't understand the scenario you just laid out, all you see is a price that goes down every day.
You're scared.
That's all you see.
Yeah.
And it's really hard because the fundamentals, both in silver and in gold, are, to my mind, as constructive as they've been at any point during this bull market, perhaps more so, particularly in gold. What do you think is the cause of this disconnect between circumstance and price action?
Because there's not there's no good reporting on these financial markets, on these commodity markets, in financial media. People only understand that the gold price and silver price are coming down every day. So that sends the message there's too much gold around, there's too much silver around. You know, just like me, that the physical demand by just two countries, India and China, is 3,000 tons a year. That's the same amount as worldwide gold mine production. So I always tell my audience when I do speeches, imagine this, the potato market. And we have two countries buying up all potatoes in the world. What will happen to the price of French fries? You know? And then everybody understands the price of French fries only can go up. And then I tell them, well, apply these same rules, fundamental supply and demand rules on the gold market. Yeah, we need to sell our gold shares. But the physical gold, you know, they're fighting for the physical gold. Now, all the London gold falls, we know from the gold analyst by Bloomberg, Kenneth Hoffman, that the London gold falls are virtually empty. He told us a year ago. From the latest research, we know over 2,000 tons of gold left London gold falls. They were all refined in Switzerland or went to the east. I always tell listeners that when China wants to have the golden eggs, I want to own the chicken who can produce the golden eggs. And who are these chicken? That's the gold companies. So selling shares in gold miners now is the most stupid thing you can do, because they're the only ones who have ounces available when there really is a shortage.
But people are frustrated, they're beaten down, and I understand it. And I talk to people about this stuff all around the world, wherever I go. You know, people have looked at exactly this case. They've looked at the investment case for owning gold. And you said something interesting, you know, 30 seconds ago. You said, it can only go up, and yet it only goes down.
Yeah.
But
in dollar terms, right, gold is in a downtrend.
And that's an important point.
And this we have seen in each and every correction. We have seen this in 2008, 2009. I was telling all my investors, in my first book in 2007, I warned for a pending dollar or credit crisis. I was told them, you have to buy gold and silver to hedge that risk. And then Lehman collapsed. What happened to the gold price? Went down 30%. Right. So they all called me, Willem, you told us to buy gold because it would be a safe haven. It goes down. I told them, relax, can take a while. And the trend of gold going down after the Lehman collapse, it continued. But gold went up in other currencies, but in dollar terms, it continued to go down. And the last gold price who was going up again and breaking out of the downtrend was the gold price in dollars. The same is happening now. Gold price in other currencies, is going up already for a year, but only in dollar terms. And that's all journalists, all investors, they look at the gold price in dollar terms. So there are powerful forces at work in the gold market to be sure gold is going down in dollar terms. And the Chinese always tell me the US designed a smokescreen surrounding the gold price. So the Chinese understand there's manipulation, and you can manipulate the gold price quite easily by selling loads of futures just on the margin, on the COMEX, and well, we know how the.
Well, okay, but that brings up another interesting point, because, and I spoke to John Hathaway about this yesterday, about this idea of extreme leverage in the gold market and hugely dwindling physical stocks. Yeah. And incredible amounts of he does absolutely
yeah.
does, and he spoke very eloquently about it, as he always does. excuse me, but it's another one of those things that when you look at it at face value, it doesn't make any sense. You know, you've got 280 claims per registered ounce on the COMEX. It's climbing.
Yeah.
Lehman went under at 33-1, but that was a problem. This isn't a problem.
It's not sustainable.
It's absolutely.
Look at the graph. It's not sustainable.
But how does that resolve itself? Because at the moment, there's limitless amounts of paper can be created.
You've seen the graph of the paper claims backed by just 1 ounce of physical gold. You have a parabolic rise now. So this has been ongoing for the last few quarters. If I look at the graph like this, it's my opinion. It can't go on for another 2 years. Maybe it can go on for another few quarters. But I wouldn't be surprised to have a real COMEX problem within 12 months. Because
there's only one way that can end. That chart can only resolve itself one way, because you're not going to increase production by 280 times.
It could end in a default, a COMEX default. Remember the potato default, 1976? There was a COMEX potato default. Somebody was short potatoes, massive. Not many people know this. They know about the Hunt brothers, in which the Hunt brothers were killed because the rules of the game were changed overnight by COMEX. But let's go back to 1976. There was a potato default because the short seller couldn't deliver. COMEX stopped trading potatoes ever since. So we could have a silver default or a gold default within COMEX. It's the end of COMEX gold trading. And we've been talking about a monetary reset or gold revaluation planned well in advance. But we have seen many crises in our monetary financial past and also in commodities. So sometimes a reset is needed because a crisis developed before you had a plan. The Weimar Revolution, there was no plan to do what do we do after the hyperinflation. They had to start thinking about it as it happened. And I think we can have a COMEX default crisis, gold, silver crisis, anytime now. And what's interesting is the London gold pool in the 1960s. Western central banks, they all dumped gold on the London physical gold market to keep gold at $35 an ounce to support the Bretton Woods system. France decided to stop cooperating. And then we had a collapse of the London gold pool in 1969. And the London gold market is just froze. It was closed for 2 weeks. And gold trading in other markets worldwide restarted at a much higher level.
Well, that's generally the way these things work, yeah. Right? I mean, but again, we're in that period where, because something hasn't happened, general consensus is it won't.
No.
And it's very dangerous.
Yeah, that's quite stupid. And I always tell investors, this really, after this correction in the last few years, this really once in a lifetime. You know why I started to invest in precious metals? In 2000, I saw a graph of the gold-dow ratio. Mm-hmm. Now, I read somewhere during the same year, it was in 2000, that Yahoo and Amazon, the market cap of Yahoo and Amazon, was over the total market cap of all listed gold mines. Then I knew gold mines were too cheap. I had to buy gold mines, and Amazon and Yahoo probably were too expensive. Currently, all listed gold mines are valued around 100 billion. Market cap of Apple is around 700 billion. Apple could buy, with his cash position, could buy all listed gold mines worldwide.
Yeah.
It truly is once in a lifetime.
But I think the problem that people have, certainly people who've been in those investments, it's been a once in a lifetime proposition about 8 times in the last 3 years. You know, and that's the problem. We can laugh about it. Yeah. It's been painful for a lot of people, you know, myself included. But the game's not over. I mean, this thing is continuing to go. They're getting cheaper. It's getting to be more of a once in a lifetime opportunity. What's the best way you can think of for anyone that hasn't suffered the pain of this trade and hasn't been in and they're kind of...
Well, I did interview Jim Mellon. Jim Mellon is quite a famous investor here in London. And I asked him, what's your position in commodities? There's only 2 or 3%, you know, he's in startups and tech. And you see the hype there, it's sexy and the valuation is sky high. You know, a guy like him should start to invest 10, 20, 30% of his net worth in commodities now and precious metals, you know. But institutional investors are out of commodities, period. The reason our fund is still alive because we don't have any institutional money, we just have retail money, and people listen to the story and still believe in it, and are long-term investors. But the institutionals are out. And I think we can reach a point where the perfect storm we have against now will turn into a perfect storm on the positive side in a few years' time. Because in a few years' time, people will start to understand there are real shortages coming. We might have had a default somewhere in gold and silver. There will be a lack of trust, or there will be a correction in broader markets, or we can have another tech implosion. If I look at the startup world, I'm an investor in some startups myself. It's ridiculous. Some management teams in startups are paid millions now in advance to come up with a good idea.
Right. Yes. Pre-idea funding. Yeah, I've seen this. It's absurd.
Then you know it's a bubble. So I think this could develop. In a few years' time, the commodity sphere, the precious metals investment world, it could develop in a perfect storm on the upside around 2020 or even before. Sorry, one more point. I recently found a graph showing the last 8 cycles in commodities. And we have had several bear markets. So these markets tend to be very violent in commodities, up and down. But once the downturn is over, in all the past 6 or 7 corrections, once the downturn is over, you see a very rapid, very strong move upwards. because there's so many commodity traders and they need to restock, you know, because commodities you can put in a warehouse. So nobody's buying, nobody's restocking as long as the price declines. So it can be violent on the upside.
So are there any, I mean, do you see anything when you look at, we talk about the gold mining stocks in particular, do you see any out there that you look at a particular company and you just go, this is crazy?
Well, we always focused on discovery plays because discoveries tend to bring the most value. They create the most value. You know, you have this $10 million company and you look 12 months later, it's a $1 billion company. And that's why I like startup investing, because with the right startups, you have the same amount of positive leverage, operational leverage. And one of our largest holdings is NexGen Energy, and that's a huge uranium discovery in Canada. And it's still valued less than $100 million. It has great upside. Reservoir Minerals, wonderful copper discovery in former Yugoslavia, Serbia. So it's still possible, even in a downturn, to make money. But yeah, we have a broad portfolio. So your broader portfolio goes down, but within the portfolio, I just looked at all the charts, and there are 12 charts now within our 80 company portfolio who didn't make any new lows in 2015. And these are the strongest companies within the sector. And this is the strongest indicator of a real change in the trend. So when the best companies are starting to move up already, while the broader trend is still down, because the UE, the gold miner index, made new lows, but the individual best companies are going up already, that's the best indicator you reach the bottom.
Now, it's interesting. Are you seeing that just in base commodities? Are you seeing any gold mining stocks do that? Because it feels like all the gold mining stocks are just going down.
No, I can show you.
I can mail you the
picture, the 13 names, and I study them. Half of them are exploration companies working on great discoveries, so Reservoir's in there, NexGen is there, but the other half are smaller producers who have made a turnaround, like Lakeshore Gold. Lakeshore Gold is highly profitable, positive cash flow, $40 million in a year with current prices. So what I like about the crash, what I like about the downturn, everything is sold. The good companies are sold as well. So if you watch who is moving up, who's moving up at the first phase of a bottoming pattern, you know these are the brightest companies. Apple and Google went down during the crash of 2008. And you can buy them for cheap, and they will recover so violently, so fast. And you see the same thing happening now with the best companies in commodities. And that's what we do in our fund. It's very actively managed, and that's why we always outperform the index. Well, we're down 4 years in a row, we outperform the index, and we always outperform the index violently on the move up.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I've taken up way too much of your time. I mean, it's fascinating stuff, all this, and hopefully you'll come back and do it again. I don't plug books, but your book, I've read the original copy. I can't wait to read the expanded one, The Big Reset. And you know, my own recommendation is to people, they should read it because it's just a fascinating.
They need to buy the revised edition because that's
When's that being published?
It has been printed last week. It will be distributed in the next few weeks. But in Amazon, you still can find both. But look for the revised edition. It has a little red note on top.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Cheers.